It is Thursday, August 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a tense wait in Zimbabwe for the results of Monday's presidential election.
There are armored personnel carriers, high-caliber weapons, and police and riot shields and water cannons on the streets of, you know, the capital of a country that's embarking on the cusp of a transition like this.
The detention of an American pastor in Turkey continues, and U.S. farmers want trade, not aid. It's all ahead. In Zimbabwe, voters waited Thursday for the results of the presidential election following Wednesday's violence when security forces clashed with protesters who were demanding to know the results. The voting took place Monday, and election officials were expected to have results by Wednesday, but they delayed the release at least one more day. In the capital, Harare, the clashes between protesters and police left three people dead, and afterward authorities invoked a law formally calling on the army to help maintain order. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell in Harare tells me the situation there.
Well, I'm looking right now at downtown Harare. And it is more or less a ghost town. The army and police went to the opposition headquarters this morning and told shopkeepers to close up shop in the area and to go home. And so the usually busy streets, I mean, it's what would be rush hour right now, and I'm seeing one or two cars on the street. So it is eerily quiet in what is usually a hive of activity. Meanwhile, at the Electoral Commission, it is a hum of activity as more and more results are coming out. We just heard more parliamentary results, and what we're seeing now is that the ruling ZANU-PF has taken a pretty wide majority in parliament. But we still don't have our presidential results, but the Electoral Commission says that they will begin to release those at 10 p.m. tonight. So everybody is, of course, expecting that. So it won't take too long. They're doing it province by province. And so that's the situation in terms of the results. Meanwhile, there's still a lot of tension. Today, opposition challenger and presidential candidate Nelson Chamisa visited people at local hospitals who were wounded in yesterday's violence. And today also, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said that he has opened a channel of communication with Chamisa, and they're trying to work through their problems and come to some sort of solution. Also, it's worth noting that the UN Secretary General urged all sides to maintain peace and to go for conversation over conflict. So it's tense, but there does appear to be some movement. Maybe we'll have a presidential result tonight.
I believe some human rights activists, though, have been commenting about yesterday's violence. What have they said?
Yes, human rights activists have been unequivocal in condemning Wednesday's violence, saying that it was completely unjustifiable for the police to call in the army, that the police were handling the situation, and that the army and the police together combined to give an unnecessary, disproportionate show of force. And as we've seen, three people have died. Human rights activists have also called for an investigation, which was something echoed by the president. He said on Twitter this morning he was going to also call for an investigation into the violence. So right now they're just condemning that. And it's worth noting also that the spokesman for the ruling party is also urging ruling party supporters to refrain from violence. So everybody's urging calm and condemning the violence.
Does there seem to be an increased presence of soldiers and police in Harare, say, as opposed to yesterday, or is it still about the same level?
You know, that's hard to say. I think it's maintained. It's hard to say whether there are more or less policemen and soldiers on the streets right now today compared to yesterday, because today is quite calm and Wednesday was rather chaotic. I think it's pretty much stayed constant. But what is remarkable is that there are these soldiers and police in riot gear on the streets at all, the same week as a historic election that was supposed to really change the fortunes of this country. I mean, that's the thing that's really striking, that the fact that there are armored personnel carriers, high-caliber weapons, and police in riot shields and water cannon on the streets of, you know, the capital of a country that's embarking on the cusp of a transition like this, of this magnitude. It just doesn't speak well to that.
VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Harare, Zimbabwe. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The Trump administration proposes freezing vehicle fuel efficiency standards. President Trump receives a letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. China and Southeast Asian nations agree to draft a conduct pact in the South China Sea, and Apple is the first public U.S. company to be valued at $1 trillion. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Is drinking coffee good or bad for you? A number of recent studies have suggested that drinking a couple of cups of coffee a day provides a number of health benefits. Meanwhile, a Superior Court judge in California recently ruled that coffee consumed in the state must be accompanied by a warning that a chemical produced during the coffee bean roasting process may cause cancer. A British-based group called the Institute for Scientific Information on Coffee brought together a group of academics, healthcare professionals, and dietitians from six European countries to examine both published and still-to-be-published studies on the health effects of coffee consumption. The group's analysis, published in a new report, finds that overall, scientific research indicates that drinking coffee is associated with a reduced risk of death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Pope Francis changes the church's teachings to oppose the death penalty. Tensions between NATO members, the United States, and Turkey increased Wednesday, with Washington sanctioning two senior Turkish officials, the Interior and Justice Ministers, over the continuing detention of American Protestant pastor Andrew Brunson. Turkey has put Brunson on trial for terrorism and espionage, insisting that he's linked to a network of supporters of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who Ankara has accused of orchestrating the failed 2016 coup and demanded his extradition from the U.S. Brunson, who was transferred to house detention after 21 months in prison last week, maintains his innocence. The White House said President Trump has been in contact many times with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, about the case, and the sanctions underscore his unhappiness over Brunson's continued detention. Atlantic Council resident senior fellow Aaron Stein tells International Edition's Victor Beatty there have reportedly been negotiations to resolve the matter, but they appear to have hit a snag.
I think the way it should be looked about is that this is the culmination of basically long-term efforts to try and get this man, Pastor Andrew Brunson, released. And if you are to believe the reporting on this, there was a Turkish reneging on the deal at the last minute, which prompted an escalatory cycle that resulted in these two men being sanctioned.
Is this a matter of internal politics in Turkey for the delay?
I mean, it's really unclear. Clearly something broke down to where negotiations with the United States ultimately became inconclusive, and that, you know, basically after 2 years of this, this administration in particular has personalized this issue. They have made the release of Pastor Brunson a top priority and are looking to gain leverage to try and bring him home.
Is there any indication Brunson is in fact involved in some illegal activity in Turkey?
If you can read Turkish and you can look at the indictment, it's farcical. So that doesn't preclude him from having run afoul of the law, although the indictment is so poorly written, full of typos, screwing up denominations of Christianity in the United States and alleging, of all things, PKK involvement. It seems fair to say that it is politicized and probably not up to American standards.
Is he really just a pawn in this whole issue of the Fethullah Gulen extradition case?
My personal hypothesis, and it's the hypothesis because nobody knows the entire facts, is they sort of stumbled into this, and that he was picked up by an overzealous police officer where he lives in Turkey as he was renewing his residency permit, and things sort of escalated from there. And so, yes, he has become a pawn, but largely by accident, comedy of errors on all sides.
Turkey, of course, has objected to the sanctions. They only affect two officials, though. Is this going to have a big problem for Turkey? The lira did hit an all-time low against the dollar.
I mean, I think the general economic downturn is the biggest problem for Turkey. The risk of escalatory cycle with the United States, presuming Turkey retaliates and puts sanctions on what would be the equivalent, the Attorney General and the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, just makes investors nervous and will help depreciate the lira well beyond sort of the immediate economic consequences of these sanctions, which are just limited to these two men.
Given what's going on in Syria and, of course, Turkey's stronger ties with Russia, how would you characterize U.S.-Turkish relations?
They're in a downward spiral. I mean, we haven't hit rock bottom, clearly, because I expect the Turks to retaliate. And this pastor hasn't been released, and the vice president has indicated that the American side will escalate if there isn't movement from the Turkish side. So somebody has to blink here, and until that happens, it's hard to hit the reset button.
Aaron Stein of the Atlantic Council. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Wednesday spoke with his Turkish counterpart about the Brunson case and plans to discuss it with him further on the sidelines of an ASEAN regional security forum this week in Singapore. The Vatican said Thursday Pope Francis has asked the church to change its teachings to reflect his view that the death penalty should be inadmissible. The new language in the Catechism of the Roman Catholic Church says the death penalty was long considered an appropriate response to certain crimes in order to protect the public, but says that now there is an increasing awareness that the dignity of the person is not lost even after the commission of very serious crimes. John Thavis is the author of Vatican Diaries. He tells me what this declaration will mean for the Catholic Church.
It's a major development. It's been a long time coming. Pope Francis, of course, had expressed his view that the death penalty is not admissible on several occasions, including during his visit to the United States. But now he has enshrined it in the official Catholic teaching, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and that takes it to a whole new level. That means that people have to ask themselves, am I committing a sin by supporting capital punishment? It's a question not only for politicians, but for Catholics around the world. I think there are more than 50 countries that still have capital punishment.
Yeah, and there are a number of U.S. politicians who are practicing Catholics who, I believe, remain in favor of the death penalty.
Right. And it's not just the politicians, it's Catholics themselves. This is an issue that has split U.S. Catholics for some time. I think latest polls show a majority against capital punishment, but still about 40% of Catholics support the idea of the death penalty. So it's a challenge, certainly, to people in the United States across the spectrum. And I think this is a case where Catholics in the U.S. are going to have to really take a good, solid look at what they believe.
Well, at least two of Pope Francis's predecessors apparently were sympathetic to it. It sounds like to this eventual goal of abolishing the death penalty.
Exactly, and it's important. This is a change in the Church's teaching. Obviously, the Church, the Catholic Church, in medieval times, supported capital punishment, and when they had temporal rule in the papal states, they helped carry it out. So this is definitely a major change in the way the Church approaches the issue. And Pope John Paul II laid the groundwork for this. So did Pope Benedict XVI. Both of them went on record as saying that, in their view, in modern times, there is little or no justification for capital punishment. Pope Francis has taken that step a little bit further, but he's made the key change here. He has enshrined it in church teaching, and he's said there is no circumstance which allows capital punishment today. And he's basing that teaching on respect for human dignity. That's important to Catholics as well, because, of course, this is the pro-life teaching of the Catholic Church now being extended to include the issue of the death penalty.
Some supporters of the death penalty might say, however, what about cases of serial killers or people that had you know, murdered more than one time, and particularly, say, vicious circumstances. What about situations like that?
Right. Well, that has been the kind of classic justification that's been used even by Catholics in the past. And I think they're going to have to take a good, hard look at what the Pope is teaching, because what he's saying is that no person, even those who have committed terrible crimes, are beyond redemption. And by putting a person to death, capital punishment, in effect, removes that possibility of a person converting and being saved. So, again, the Pope sees it as an affront to human dignity, with the idea that human life begins at conception and ends at natural death, and that there should be no intervention by means of capital punishment. That would be a violation of that human dignity.
Author John Favis. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is International Edition. Since May, the price per bushel of soybeans has dropped almost 20% in the wake of an escalating trade war between the United States and China. Tariffs threaten to cut off an important export market for U.S. farmers, while also cutting into profits for farmers already experiencing a fifth year of declining farm income. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, despite plans for a massive aid package by the Trump administration, what producers want most is reliable access to the world's largest markets.
The rolling and robust fields of soybean growing on Fred Greeter's Illinois farm would be a welcome sign most years, indicating a promising harvest in the fall. But tariffs are turning away potential customers overseas, and Greeter estimates he could lose around $100 an acre if the trade war continues.
It's a squeeze.
A squeeze acknowledged by the Trump administration, prompting the U.S. Department of Agriculture to plan a $12 billion aid package to help farmers like Greeter.
If you take the $12 billion, which, assuming it'll all go to beans, which it won't, and divide that by our planted acreage, that's about $14 an acre.
And you're looking at a $100 loss an acre.
That's correct.
So you're still out $76.
That's correct.
It's not that Greeter isn't grateful. He'd just rather have trade over aid.
The aid package certainly is appreciated, and we appreciate the fact that USDA and the president is concerned about us and wants to try to make us whole. But the reality is that the numbers in a large trade war like this are just overwhelming.
This is not a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster. It's not an act of God, but some would call it an act of foolishness.
Mark Albertson is the Director of Strategic Market Development for the Illinois Soybean Association. He says the trade dispute with China is a greater threat to farmers than the drought of 2012.
But we had mechanisms in place to deal with that, and we always knew that the very next year we would be able to plant our crops again and hope for the best. In this case, we don't know that. We don't know what the next year brings. We don't have necessarily hope of the trade war going away very soon, and it looks like Brazil is all too eager to take away our market share when it comes to China.
Which is Farmer Greeter's biggest concern.
Brazil, one of our largest competitors. They're always expanding. So this could affect our markets years down the road. And I'm probably more worried about that than I am just a short-term washout here.
The other challenge is what to do with the soybeans that can't be sold.
It looks like we may end up putting a record amount of soybeans in storage. And when that happens, we know from history that the prices will go south.
For now, Greeter's routine remains the same. He hopes strong global demand for soybeans outside China will make up for decreasing prices, and is waiting to see if President Donald Trump's trade tactics will work before permanent damage is done to the reputation and reliability of U.S. grain products.
I support what he's trying to do. I can't say that I support his methods.
Methods that could create greater uncertainty and smaller profits for U.S. farmers. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Bloomington, Illinois.
A look at the continuing trade situation. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a written statement issued on July 25th, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo clearly and unequivocally rejected any possibility that the United States will accept Russia's attempted annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. On February 27, 2014, Russian forces wearing masks and no military insignia infiltrated Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, took over the Supreme Council of Crimea, and proceeded to capture strategic sites across the peninsula. Ultimately, this action led to the installation of a pro-Russian government in Crimea, and in March, an illegitimate, fabricated referendum there that attempted to legitimize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory. Russia, through its 2014 invasion of Ukraine and its attempted annexation of Crimea, sought to undermine a bedrock international principle shared by democratic states that no country can change the borders of another by force, said Secretary Pompeo. Nearly 80 years ago, the United States issued the Wells Declaration, which refused to recognize the then Soviet Union's invasion of the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. For the next five decades, the declaration remained a cornerstone of U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union. The people of the United States are opposed to predatory activities, no matter whether they are carried on by the use of force or by the threat of force, states the Wells Doctrine. They are likewise opposed to any form of intervention on the part of one state, however powerful, in the domestic concerns of another sovereign state, however weak. That principle has not changed, said Secretary Pompeo. As we did in the Wells Declaration in 1940, the United States reaffirms as policy its refusal to recognize the Kremlin's claims of sovereignty over territory seized by force in contravention of international law. In concert with allies, partners, and the international community, the United States rejects Russia's attempted annexation of Crimea and pledges to maintain this policy until Ukraine's territorial integrity is restored. The United States calls on Russia to respect the principles to which it has long claimed to adhere and to end its occupation of Crimea, he said. Through its actions, Russia has acted in a manner unworthy of a great nation and has chosen to isolate itself from the international community.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.